And we're on the record, a music podcast discussing all things music just because we're two cool dudes that fucking love music. Who are the cool dudes? It is us once again, Ringer and the J-Man, bringing you a topic this week, a wonderful topic, one that definitely got us thinking and kind of living the old ways of nostalgia, kind of those artists that we have yet to see or never will see, but we want to put them in a special space. So today we will have that topic ahead of you, but Ringer, we hear that you have a new artist alert that we got to go through in this week in music. What's been shaking?
Not too much. Before I get into this week in music artist, just want to let everyone know that we are on social media, Facebook and Instagram and YouTube, all at On The Record Music. You can also visit us at our website at www.ontherecordmusic.com. You can sign up for our email list there, and you can also sign up for our email list from your show description in your podcast player. Don't worry, we don't send you spam. We're not going to just give you some random shit. It'll only be valuable, useful information, updates about the show, what's going on, some cool articles, things like that.
I mean, we could send you spam.
We could, but we won't.
No, yeah, we won't send you the spam.
So we got this little thing coming up next week. Now, we've been doing the show for a while. So long, in fact, that...
Long time.
Next week is our 100th episode.
Oh, yeah.
We're making it to 100 episodes. So we got a kind of a regular episode coming up. But the special thing about next week is we're going to have some big announcements for the show. Some big things, some big things happening, big changes maybe. So tune in next week if you want to hear some of those changes and what's going to happen for this podcast and you, the listener.
Definitely listen in for that 100. Nothing too special. We might wear bow ties. We might get dressed up for this, but we figured we'll just keep rolling with the punches. Yeah. It's great times ahead of us for Ringer. We got the first 100 down. We're going to get another 100 up.
So for this week in music, I had a little new artist that I just wanted to share with everyone. Someone that I just kind of randomly heard on the radio and I hadn't heard before. And it's an artist by the name of Zach Bryan. Had no idea who this was. I was just driving in my car and I heard this song called Heading South on the radio. I would describe it, Zach Bryan, as kind of country meets like a John Butler Trio, Dave Matthews type. So kind of take that as you will, but it's kind of a cross between those two genres, which was actually kind of cool. I just really liked the song. It kind of just stuck out with me and went home and just listened to some more and did a little deep dive and I was a fan. Like, I think it's really good music. Been listening to him quite a bit over the last few weeks. Don't know too much else about the guy, but it's definitely worth a listen. So if you're looking for new music, check out Zach Bryan, wherever you listen to music.
All right, Zach Bryan. Yeah, that definitely is a new name for me, but John Butler Trio is fucking phenomenal. So if it's kind of that country meets them a little bit, that's great. Nice little Dave Matthews kind of pop, possibly. Yeah, that sounds like something I would want to check that puppy out for sure. But the question is, Ringer, is he an artist that you would want to see?
I would go see him, but he's probably not the artist that I'm dying to see the most, or if I could choose one, maybe not the one I would choose. At least not yet. I want to be fair to the guy. I don't know yet.
Yeah, it's up in the air. Yeah.
Getting to our main event of today, of this week, we're answering the question, if you could see any band or artist at any time, at any place, who would it be and why? Now, I love this question because, well, first, I heard it at a party, I think. I was having a conversation with someone. I don't know who it was. I don't know where it was. I don't know when it was. But I remember someone asked this question. They basically said, if you could see any band or artist, who would you see and why? And it could be anybody from... They can be together, they can be not, they can be living, they can be dead, it doesn't matter. Who would you see and why? And I just really like that question, because it's kind of a cool question. And as music fans, it really gets you thinking. And plus, and it's kind of a, it's just good icebreaker, because I heard that and I was like, I'm going to steal this question, and I'm going to ask people. It's a great icebreaker in real life when you meet people and you don't like to do small talk. I always find that this is a really good question to get people like thinking if they have some inclination towards music. And, you know, luckily most people have some sort of inclination towards music and they can at least name somebody that they would see. So it's a great question just to ask people in general, but it's also a fun one just to think about as music fans. And so I thought it'd be a good idea to let's bring this on the podcast and let's talk about this one on the air.
Yeah, definitely. I think this is a great question. You brought this one up. We usually share ideas and we have a whole idea list. And this one was always popped out to me. So I'm glad we're kicking it off with this one. And, you know, it kind of like ties into our episode 13, where we were talking into our favorite concerts of our experiences. And, you know, these are just artists that we want to see, but we talked like our favorite ones back then. And I tell you what, this is kind of a nice different dive and a nice different angle in that aspect, because we could place these artists in anywhere we want to, including ones that they've already have done. I do got to admit, this really was a little bit of a struggle, though, for me, just kind of looking back on all the artists that I haven't seen and some that I have seen, where it's like, well, maybe I didn't see them in the right spot and it really wasn't the best experience at the time. Do I want to really relocate that? But literally, I picked a pretty good list of five people that I haven't seen. Well, I guess, no, I have seen one of them, I guess. So that's where it came out of. But the other four I have not seen in any type of form at all. So it would just make it for just a new experience. And I'm kind of thinking of, you know, spots that, but placing them in spots that I think were just perfect for what I think a concert experience should be like, you know?
So when you were having your struggles, what ultimately gave you the kick to make a pick?
You know, you just have to go by your, just kind of like your standard settings of, okay, who are my favorite artists? Who are these people that I say, well, I love them so much in my life, but I haven't seen them yet? And so you'll see that there's, if people have been listening, you, of course, Ringer, know me pretty well. So these will kind of like ring true, but then you'll see like where I'm trying to place them into my ideal venue or spot to play. But most people, if you listen to our podcast quite a bit, you'll understand that some of these artists I'm going to mention are personal favorites. We did have a rule on here that was in our notes that people won't see, but Beatles were excluded from this list. So,
yep.
As per Ringer, that wanted to make sure that I just didn't go all Beatles. So,
it's the whole time. It's the obvious one. It's the obvious one. Although I may have broke my own rule, but since the question is designed for you to pick one, yeah. I picked one and it's not the Beatles, but I might talk about them later in the show for kind of a related reason. But so I kind of broke my own rule, but I also didn't.
See, that's the main struggle. I had to go around the one, you know.
Right. Yeah. It's like, well, you're going to pick the Beatles, but when, and, you know, so yeah, I.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, everybody knows it would be the rooftop concert. No, I'm just kidding. There's better areas.
Well, and that's the thing with this show, like with this question specifically, we set it up in a way that it doesn't have to be a show that actually happened. You could pick a band and put them at a venue that they haven't played at, or a festival and a time period too. You could see them at any time. So it's kind of loose of like, yeah, I would see the Beatles at this place that they actually didn't play. Or you can be like, oh, I would actually want to see them play at Ed Sullivan show. Like, I want to see that show, that kind of thing. So you could make it a real concert that actually happened, or you can kind of build your own lineup, so to speak.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, to be honest too, actually, one of the entries I was considering was my uncle's band back in the 80s, because there was this one party that they went to, and they had this, it was a triplex, and everybody was in the second or third level, and without word, people just started going to the funneling to the basement, and then my uncle's band like played this really great set that they just weren't great playing live yet, and this set kind of gave them more confidence, and then they started recording. I was like, even thinking of things like that, try to go as deep as possible into my historic memory of like, oh, should I consider like ideas like that?
Yeah, and that's a tough thing, because what do you go for? Do you go for the iconic concert that like people talk about? Do you go for something that's maybe notorious, something that's historic, or just a concert that might have great vibes or a great experience overall? Do you go for something? How do you choose exactly? Do you go for something small, something intimate, something big? You can really go any direction with it. There are no rules, but that was kind of my thought process, at least, of like, is there something I'm looking for in particular? And I guess the answer was kind of yes, but also kind of no. And we'll kind of see that as we talk about some of these different ones. But one thing that did pop into my mind, this question of like, are we kind of setting ourselves up for failure with this one? Like, you know, they say never meet your heroes because you'll be let down. Yeah. Is this, are we kind of setting ourselves up for failure here of like, we don't actually want to see these shows because maybe we built them up so much in our head that we're going to see them and actually be like, you know, that it was fine, but it wasn't like worldly legendary.
Yeah, I know. That was one of the fears. But that's one thing that I did stipulate in my analysis of like trying to pick the right one is, okay, what era is this band or artist that I'm looking at? Which one do I want and where do I want to place them? So it wasn't just venue, but it was actual era of the artist, you know, of like, okay, what section of their career, their timeline, were they, would I deem them playing best based off of other people's perspective? And it's like, ooh, yeah. Okay. So that's where I kind of dug into a little bit more with that, where it made it much more, it was like definitely like four layered, you know, 4D chess almost, you know, like they're playing on Big Bang or something. And it's just like, damn, just like kind of crazy to really go down that list. But it kind of helped out to whittle the list a little bit more when I, you know, I started off with close to 12 and it easily whittled down just by focusing on by the artist. And
sure.
And one thing that you did mention there, Ringer, was kind of being set up for disappointment by seeing like the legends or your idols or heroes in that aspect. And I kind of go the other way with that. Like, you never want to miss out on seeing a legend, as you famously wrote in one of our blogs from October of 2020. Sure did. And that's a very good point. After Eddie Van Halen died, it's kind of like, yeah, I'll never get this. I will never have that opportunity to see Van Halen. And so there is new technology where we can actually, hopefully in the future here, I mean, they're doing it right now, but they are bringing some of our legends back with holograms and shit like that. And this has been practiced as early as 2012, but there's technology that shows dead artists and performing their material and new verbiage, new language that they can create using their voices. But one of the most famous aspects of it was Tupac Shakur at Coachella in 2012, where they had him perform, I think, two of his songs, one with Snoop Dogg even, and he was performing his songs, but then they also had new words. Like, he's like, "What's up, Coachella? Welcome to 2012," and stuff like that. So, like, they have these aspects where they can bring and set up artists, like we're mentioning here, like we're about to mention, they can pretty much do exactly what we're talking about almost.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know how I feel about that. I mean, I'm not against it, but also I think it's one of those things like that might be a cool experience, but it's still not the same.
Yeah.
Because that's not actually them. You know, it's a hologram. So I think seeing that by itself as it's, or seeing that happen, knowing it's happening, yeah, that might be kind of cool. But I don't think like that can really replace the true joy or the true experience of actually seeing the artist. But I think it might become more common. And this could be easily like an old man take already, like, oh, that technology, and you know, it's not the same as it was. And it, maybe in 20 years, I'm going to be dead wrong about that. And everyone's going to be like, yeah, I'm totally cool with that. It's the fucking same thing to me. I don't give a shit. And I might look like the old guy who's yelling at the clouds.
Yeah, I know. It's like, do you invest in Amazon in 1999 or not? You know, it's kind of like, should we be investing in this hologram stuff? But one thing I thought about this a while back when I first saw the Michael Jackson one, which they did one at the, I think it was the Billboard Awards in 2014. I kind of thought, man, that's actually a pretty cool technology where I would actually do it for, like, if I had a chance, like if my dream is opening my own music venue and kind of have like stand-up comedy and like good food and shit, I think it would be fun to like do a George Carlin one. You know, you get like stand-up comedy, you do a couple different ones for certain things. But I don't think I think the experience when you're seeing that is the technology. It's not literally the experience of seeing the artist. So you're correct on that. And that's what steals the air out of the balloon for me.
Well, the other thing though is too, like, is that going to include new material? Because we know that AI is capable of that. You sent me that link a few weeks ago and it was a like AI song of a like what Nirvana would sound like, their next song, or like a song from their next album. And I listened to it and it was like scary good. and it was written by a computer, and it was like, this could have definitely been like a next Nirvana song had Kurt Cobain not died. And it was kind of scary how spot on it was. And I think that could happen a lot, lot more. So really, you could see George Carlin do an entire new stand-up set that was written by AI and see a hologram version of him. I don't know how I feel about that. I mean, it's cool.
I know.
But it's also like, is that okay? I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. It would be very difficult, but I would love to see that since he was such diverse with his language. It'd be fun to see him really fuck with the AI just with the language barrier right there because he goes deep on some things. But
right.
I agree. It is kind of a scary aspect. Like I think the same article I sent to you had the Amy Winehouse song that they did as well, Club 27, as we mentioned before once in our podcast. But even the Amy Winehouse one sounded so fresh and so kick-ass where it's just like, damn, was this literally something that was on the cutting room floor or it literally was AI creation? Damn, it was that close because it was AI creation where I'm like, fuck, that's on point.
Right. So I guess we're almost starting a new topic here, but are we all screwed? Like as musicians and music fans and lovers of art and movies and all of that stuff, like, is everybody just screwed? Because if a computer can write a Nirvana song that sounds like Nirvana and is actually pretty good, what's stopping it from just taking over the entire music industry or the entire movie industry? Like, I want to believe that the people will prevail and kind of always be rooted in that, because part of what music is that emotional connection. You identify with some of your favorite bands and artists. You see yourself in them. I don't know if you can replicate that with AI. Clearly, it can make good music, but people didn't love Kurt Cobain because only of his great music. They did love that part of it, but there was also some sort of connection that they felt to him, whether they also felt like an outcast or an underdog, and that's kind of who he was or how he was presented anyway. And so people have that connection as well. So maybe that's the saving grace that I'm grasping for as I'm going underwater here, just trying to grab anything to keep the future of music alive. I don't know. I don't want to go down that pessimistic rabbit hole right now, but I don't know. That could be a whole nother topic that we dive into. And maybe we have to get some AI experts and musicians in here that can give us some more expert opinion.
Yeah. Do a little more research on that puppy, but right now they're heading down that road of possibly setting up artists that we want to see, you know, and that's the weird thing, and having new material. So the AI capabilities have been going strong the last 10 years, it feels like, since the Tupac incident with the hologram. But I think it's a different world out there with these kind of types of inventions where it would be a great experience, but not the experience that we're going to be talking about right now.
Right. So we are going to talk about people we can see live, but we can actually see these people live because this is our question and our show and we do what we want. So I guess I have one question for you. And is, if you could see any band or artist living or dead at any time, who would it be and why?
If I had to say anything, Ringer, I had to go. And this is where I was taking the artist on their timeline when they were the best performance. And when to see them. And I kind of kept them in the same time era that they were really, really great because I feel like it would just be more natural that way. But I want to see Fleetwood Mac anywhere in the world in spring and summer of 1969. So this is definitely one of the best live show era lineups of Fleetwood Mac. Everybody knows I'm a pretty big Peter Green fan, so that's where it comes in. Peter Green, just absolutely love him. Bluesman guitars, absolutely love it. This is shortly about 6 months after getting Danny Kirwan, who was only 19 at the time. They added guitarist Danny Kirwan to the shuffle, and this followed my favorite album, which is more blues-driven, but Mr. Wonderful, which was released in October of 1968. And so this is a blues, more blues than rock, but has light touches of rock. era of them. And I really think this is like the perfect blend of blues and rock. They were getting into more rock and more experimental music as what would be shown on Then Play On. So this is their middle era of Mr. Wonderful, their second album, and Then Play On with their third. So this really cool shuffling, Danny Kirwan and Peter Green working in collaboration, not just in songwriting aspects, but also just on guitar. So seeing them live is really, really good. Like when I watch some of their old videos of them playing out in Paris, when them playing out in Germany, I see a great rhythm section kicking ass. I see great guitarist work from Peter Green, Danny Kirwan, and Jeremy Spencer, who is the king of slide blues guitar in England at the time, was the best. So you're getting three different guitars, really kicking ass. They got a great song catalog, and I'll talk about songs that you need to hear when they're live at that time. But you really look at it. There's three different singers, three different guitarists, dynamic group of musicians, several different styles of music going on. It is absolutely wonderful. Some of the comments about their guitar playing, Peter Green was said, or B.B. King said of Peter Green that he gave Peter, when listening to Peter Green, B.B. King said it gave him the cold sweats just listening to him play. It's just absolutely wonderful. John Mayall, right when Peter Green played his first concert with him, that after Peter Green replaced Eric Clapton in the Blues Breakers, John Mayall said he easily surpassed Clapton. I mean, it's just great. And then at the time when Peter Green was tutoring Danny Kirwan, he was trying to, you know, before he recruited him into Fleetwood Mac, Danny Kirwan was getting rave reviews about his blues guitars, including being possibly one of the best English blues guitar reps of that time. So in general, this group is fucking killing it and they're just kick ass. And to say it, I've never seen Fleetwood Mac live in any form of the matter, but my main draw would be to see Danny Kirwan and Peter Green. And Peter Green never really left the United States because he broke down of schizophrenia, unfortunately, in the 70s. So he never really left England to do anything, even though he still continued to play live in the England area. So definitely, if I had to see any group, any artist, it would be Peter Green for sure, but that whole group with that lineup in the 69, in the time that they were growing, I would want to see that group. And at this time, songs I would want to hear when they're on stage, which they did play intermittently at times, Black Magic Woman, they wrote that song that Santana made famous, more popular in America and throughout the world. Great interpretation, by the way, Santana. Good job on that one. Need Your Love So Bad, one of the greatest love songs. Love playing that. If you got a honey or a hubby at home and you just want to kind of like do a slow dance, pull up Need Your Love So Bad. Would be great in the concert. World Keep on Turning is absolutely wonderful. Albatross is actually one of their most famous songs of all time. And then one of Danny Kirwan's, one of my favorite ones, that's just kind of hidden track, but it's a great blues rocker and he rips it on guitar. Something Inside of Me is the song. Look it up. But that is the group. That is the era. That is the lineup I want to see the most, because Peter Green is not just a hero, but he is a legend. The group itself is legendary with this deep, deep story. It's just absolutely wonderful. So you're seeing the very beginnings. They're turning from blues to rock, and then they kind of get into that pop realm after Peter Green leaves and Jeremy Spencer leaves, and it's Bob Welsh, Danny Kirwan, Christine Perfect, who's Christine McVie, gets in the group, and they kind of turn a little bit pop right after, about a year after this part. So you're really seeing a great depth of a band and artist at this time. So Fleetwood Mac and Peter Green, you're my number one, baby.
You know, I didn't know what you were going to pick, but I'm also like, I'm not surprised either that you went with Fleetwood Mac, just given the way you talked about them. But I honestly had no idea where you were going to go. I didn't know if you'd go kind of a classic band like Fleetwood Mac, or if you go someone newer or somewhere in the middle, or some like, I thought you might pull some like obscure blues guy or something just like deep down in the water. But I think you made a good choice with Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah, I think that's one that I feel like would give me the all-around experience. Seeing Peter Green just play guitar would, even if it was just him plucking the E note on stage eating a ham sandwich, it's like I would pay for that. You know, I would, just because it's like fucking cool. All right, so that was my number one ringer. Where are you going with your first choice?
So when I was thinking about this, I was just trying to run through a list of names and bands that I really like, that I've grown up listening to, people that have influenced me, and also playing with that idea of like, you know, do I want to see something that's iconic? Do I want to just kind of put my own thing together? And eventually what I ended up settling on kind of actually surprised me a little bit, because I almost thought this might have been too cliche that I even went with this answer. But I chose to see, if I could see anyone living or dead at any time, I would see Jimi Hendrix at the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967. And now I thought that one, because that one's kind of like, that one's notorious. It's iconic. It's known. That's the show where he burned his guitar on the stage after the last song, smashed it around. Like, that's that show. And it's iconic. There's photos, there's posters. I had a poster of it at one point. So it's a well-known show. So maybe a little too on the head. But when I think about it, I think just with Jimi Hendrix in general, there's arguably no one that's more influential for the direction of modern rock than Jimi Hendrix is. Even if you don't like him or don't listen to his music, because I know a lot of people who are good guitar players are like, I don't like Jimi Hendrix. I don't think he's very good or whatever. You know, there's, you can name criticisms there, but I think he had so much influence on so many people, and just the way he brought fast playing guitar into pop culture. Like, he wasn't the first to do this. He wasn't the first to play that guitar in that way necessarily, but he was the first to bring it to that next level and bring it to the mainstream. And so I think that is one of the reasons why I would want to see this show, is because this was kind of that show that, looking back through history glasses, is kind of that turning point for music forever. So I just felt like I really needed to be at that show. Plus, Jimi Hendrix, like, he brought those wild solos. He was loud. That was another thing he brought too, was like being loud. Like, rock is associated with being loud. He was kind of one of the reasons why, because he would just crank the shit out of his music. And if you listen to any song from this show specifically, there's clips on YouTube. You can listen to the album wherever. It's loud. You can just tell it's loud by how overdriven everything is, and just it pushes right up to that volume limit. But also his stage presence, he was eccentric, he was sexual. I mean, he basically like had sex with his guitar while he's trying to light it on fire, humping the amps and shit. It was great stage performance. And then he kind of also just brought like that fuzz and the wah really into the mainstream. Those are two pedals that are always going to be associated with him as the person who made them iconic. So he did a lot for music, whether you like him or not. And so this was just one that I had to be at. And the cool thing, or the weird thing about this show, is when he did all that shit, so especially at the end. So he only played 9 songs. It wasn't a very long set. And that's typical, like, for a festival set to be a little bit shorter. But when I looked actually at that whole tour, he was only playing like 9 to 11 songs per show, which is not a lot. I don't know if that was common for that time. Maybe just people were only playing 10 songs, or, I mean, that was, he only had the one album, but he did a lot of covers. But so he didn't play a lot at this festival, but it's iconic. And it's because of what he does at the end there. But the interesting thing about it is, if you watch the video clip of him destroying his guitar, the crowd, like, you can hear some people cheering, but the crowd is actually kind of silent, which now we think about it is like this mega event, and the crowd would go absolutely nuts for it because it's become iconicized. But the crowd was, I don't know if they were in shock. I don't know if they didn't like it. It's really hard to say. There's interviews of people who were there, and some people were just like, I didn't know how to react. I was so just in shock, because no one had ever seen anything like this before. Now, yes, the Who were smashing their guitars and their instruments, and so it was happening. But also at this time, there's not the internet. So there's not social media. There's not even really like bootleg videotapes that just go around that people can get. And so people may have heard of these things happening, but people aren't really seeing them happen that much. And you think it may be a rumor until you actually see it. So you're kind of blown away when you see it. And so that's probably why they react the way they did. It'd be cool now just to go back and be in that crowd and experience that crowd from that moment. So the reason he was into lighting his guitar on fire is kind of this rivalry with the Who. And it started out, this wasn't actually the first time that he had lit his guitar on fire. The first time he did it was at Finsbury Park, Astoria in England. And he was sitting around backstage with some of the band members and managers and people like that. And they were trying to figure out like how they could top the Who, because he was kind of doing the same, like destroying instruments. But the Who was already doing that. And they were like, well, do you want to just be compared to the guy who's trying to do what the Who is doing? And they were talking, and one of the managers or somebody was like, what if you light your guitar on fire? And then Jimmy sits there for like 10 seconds and then he turns to someone and he's like, go get a bottle of lighter fluid. and the rest was history. And he lit his guitar on fire that night and then did it again at this show because, of course, the Who were playing at this show and they were set to headline that night because they won a coin flip, and that lit a fire under Hendrix, pun very much intended on that one. And he lit his guitar on fire. But he also, if you just watch that last clip, so it's the last song is Wild Thing, and he just absolutely just goes ham on the solos. It's loud. It's crazy. It's so good. It's just really fun to watch. So I can't imagine being there. It would be such an experience. So that's kind of why I have to go with him in this show specifically. And plus, he was just one of those guys, going back to his influence, he influenced a lot of my favorites. I mean, he was also an influence on me, but also I can hear his playing in John Frusciante of the Red Hot Chili Peppers, John Mayer in his blues stuff, Mike McCready of Pearl Jam, just to name a few. You can hear Hendrix through these guys. Hendrix and Gilmour are probably the two players that I can trace my style of play back to. Neither are necessarily my favorite guitar player, but I can definitely hear myself in both of them. And so I'm just a big fan of guys that they also influenced. Plus, there's the myth of the 27 Club. And this might be like the best way to get let down that I was talking about, of like, we hold that group of people in such high regard. Were they actually that good? I don't know. We talked about that on the 27 Club episode. Also, it's just an iconic performance. So yeah, that is one that history still talks about to this day. And then I guess one other reason would just be the time period. I think if I could experience any other time period, it would be the late 60s, early 70s, especially for music. It's just so many of my favorites and people who are influenced by my favorites come from this period. And plus, rock music was where it was at. Like, rock music was king. So there's so many people in that era I would love to see. Bob Dylan, especially when he went electric. The Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, Janis Joplin, all around this time period would be absolutely insane. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's so many more people and bands and artists that we could see around that time that we could talk about forever. But those are some of the main reasons. And so, yes, this is the show. If I could see any show, any artist, living or dead, at least right now, it's Jimi Hendrix, Monterey Pop, 1967.
Nice choice, Ringer. That he was on my list as well, but I had a little bit different thing. I didn't even think of Monterey Pop, so that was actually a really good choice. I was just kind of like trying to play somewhere I'd want to, but you just reminded me that when... For this, right before Monterey Pop Fest, he was touring and he was opening for the Monkees. And could you imagine that crowd? A teeny right. boppers over here. And then first guy comes out is Jimi Hendrix and he's humping his guitar. Could you imagine what that crowd was like?
That's when you get some of those iconic or notorious performances, is when people aren't expecting or don't know what they're getting into. And then out comes Jimi Hendrix, this charismatic stage presence guy who's opening for this pop band that appeals to kids, and then it just, everyone's like, that fucking sucked. Or like Dylan going electric, like people were like, that was the worst shit I've ever seen, he's fucking Judas for doing that. And so yeah, any of those concerts would be really cool to see.
And one last Jimi Hendrix note, now that I'm thinking off the top of my head, one of the cool concerts that I think would be really good to go to, if we had to pick one spot in Jimmy's timeline, would be June 3rd. It was Sunday, June 3rd, 1967. 2 days after Sgt. Pepper was released, George Harrison and Paul McCartney went to go see Jimi Hendrix live. June 1st was the release date of Sgt. Pepper. June 3rd, they're watching Jimi Hendrix. Jimi Hendrix opens with Sgt. Pepper. Like, literally, he learned the song in 2 days. Jimi Hendrix learned Sgt. Pepper. Paul McCartney still to this day says that was one of the greatest nods to not just us, but recognizing how great Jimmy was.
Right.
You mentioned earlier that you put Beatles in your list, and I got a secret to tell you. I do too. I still went against the course of it, so I still have the Beatles on my list. And so we'll kind of I'll continue on with my who artists I would love to see, and I want to say the Beatles. But it's not like the rooftop concert. It's not anything else. It's more or less the Beatles when they were in Hamburg circa 1961, and they were playing at this place called the Star Club. This is actually one of the top billing spots to go to for musicians at that time. So the reason I would want to see the Beatles in here is because I want to see them before they had the mop tops. So actually, this is right around when they got them. But I want to see them before the mop tops, before the ties and suits came on. I think that's why I really love the Beatles in the White Album era a lot, because they stripped away all of that stuff. They were doing the psychedelic stuff, but then they moved on from the psychedelic stuff. And so it was kind of like the Beatles raw after what they've all been through the previous 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Please Please Me up till Magical Mystery Tour, basically. So I want to see them in their rawest form. And this definitely is the rawest form of the early Beatles there is, except for this has Pete Best instead of Ringo Starr. But they were coming into their own. They played hours and hours and hours on end in Hamburg, and they honed their skills, really like kicking ass now, because they played on stage, were popping pills, drinking beers, and it was just great. They were drawing in big size crowds, so that's where they kind of moved on up to the Star Club. So they're getting recognized more and more often. And these shows were really cool. One, these were the shows where they finally got they had more money from playing lots of hours and getting lots of money and living in the backstage of the Kaiser Keller in Hamburg. They got their iconic instruments and the mop top looks, but then they also had the leather jackets, kind of be tough teddy boys and stuff like that. So they have the iconic look and everything, but they were still on stage having fun, like John Lennon coming out in his tidy whiteys and his big thick glasses, which he was always shy about. He comes out and just starts reading poetry, you know, and the band's playing music in the background, or George Harrison walking around with playing guitar, singing with a toilet seat around his neck, or, you know, Paul McCartney ripping his shirt off and, you know, maybe it wasn't, you know, stage diving yet, but it was more or less like getting into the crowd and kind of playing around with them, but they didn't go too far because they'd get in fights. So to me, I think this is like, this era of the Beatles is the truest nature of the Beatles that you'll get until they got cleaned up. They had to have, you know, they had to play it safe, you know, so that they could play for the Queen and for the teenagers and stuff like that. So this is the only way I want to see the Beatles if I were to see them live. And I know they got a bad rap for playing live and not sounding good, but you also got to look, they were the first ones to be touring in big stadiums. They were the first ones to really have 100% of the show be screaming at them once they were popular. Like, it was a jetliner, basically, that they if you were to stand behind a jetliner and try to play I Want to Hold Your Hand, yeah, you're not going to sound that good, especially with Ringo. Ringo is famous for saying that he had to watch their little butts to see them switch and, you know, and understand what part of the song they were in, because he couldn't hear them for the majority of the time. So they got a bad rap for not being good live, but this is the truest way to hear them live. And from everywhere that they went, they drew in big crowds because of their live sound. So to me, if you ought to say anything, this is the best Beatles era you'd want to see them live in. And this is the rawest form. And yeah, I got to say, I broke the rules. I'm still mentioning Beatles, but it's also pre-Beatles. I was thinking about doing when they were the Silver Beatles so I could get away with it, because it's spelled B-E-E-T-L-E-S, like the actual bug. So I was going to almost go that route, but I'm like, no, I need to do the next step up when they officially became the Beatles in Hamburg and they were kicking ass.
I think you're almost right. And what I mean by that is, yeah, I think if you're going to see the Beatles when they existed, this would probably be the time to do it, because I wouldn't want to see them when they did their American tour, because like you said, it was so loud. And I think those shows kind of came notorious for how bad they were, not for any of their faults, because they had thousands of hours of live experience under their belt, but because it was so loud with the screaming, you couldn't hear anything. And I've heard live clips of that tour. And yeah, it's bad. Like, it's hard to hear. It wouldn't be enjoyable from a music perspective. But what I would want to see the Beatles, or when I would want to see the Beatles, is a time when they didn't exist. And so I would like to see the Beatles today, as in within the last 10 to 20 years, because I think given all that time, and so this would A, require them to be together, but also you kind of need a couple people to be living. John Lennon and George Harrison are both no longer with us, so they would also have to be alive. But I think if the Beatles continue together, even if they weren't together the entire time, because they would have broken up, but I'm guessing that at some point they would have gotten back together, at least to do some touring. I would like to see them within the last 10 to 20 years, because I think they could really refine their stage show and make it more of an experience. I think that'd be really cool to see. I'm, again, hoping that that's what they would do. But really, I would like to see them in like a theater of like a 6,000 to 8,000 person theater, where they just do like a full stage show, and it's really cool. I would settle for an arena, so like a 10,000 to 15,000 or 18,000 people. I wouldn't want to see them in a stadium. That's too big. I'm not a huge fan of stadium shows. They're kind of a cool experience, but
yeah,
they're so big. It's like, it's really hard to feel intimate. Like, I've seen Paul McCartney at Target Field when I worked at Target Field. I did see the Rolling Stones at at TCF Bank Stadium where the Gophers play. And those are fun shows, but they're so big. It's like, it's really hard to feel totally intimate at those kind of venues. So I would really like to see the Beatles at like the 6,000 to 8,000 person theater where they do some cool stage show and really get trippy with it. Like, that's what I would like to see. And I'd like to see them, you know, when I guess they would all be in their 50s or 60s or 70s, depending on the exact time frame. But I think that would make for a really good show. I think they could do a really, really good job. I mean, Paul McCartney shows are great. So, you know, like, he would probably bring that same mindset to these shows. And I'm guessing the rest of the band would as well. Paul McCartney shows are big. They're fun. There's a good mix of hits and some new music. But it's really just getting up on stage and playing. Like, there's some pyro and stuff. I would really like to see them do more of that Pink Floyd, or even like today, Muse, I think, does a great live show that's just so trippy. So like the music's just half of it. I would like to see them do something like that. And I'd like to see them do that like now. I think that'd be really cool.
Yeah, I actually think that they could actually, you bring up a good point. They have the Cirque du Soleil Love show. They could actually mirror that and actually play the new mixes of those songs together and actually maybe perform like a small part of that show live just for the audience, and it would sell out. But I agree with you, it'd be great to see them in a 6,000 seat theater. I guarantee you that if U2 is selling out, you know like 150 million per tour, the Beatles would also do that. They would be on par, if not outdoing them, and especially if they did it as infrequent as I would think they would do it. But they would crush it in a heartbeat.
Right. And that would have to be a personal decision that the band makes. And if there's any band that would do it, it could be the Beatles, where they're like, hey, we're only going to do small venue shows because that's what we want to do. Because, they could sell out the biggest of stadiums all around the world and make tons of money. But if they're not in it for the money, which they may or may not be at that point, who knows? They could be the band that goes like, you know, like Bob Dylan is a great example of this. He plays small shows. Now, granted, Bob Dylan probably wouldn't be selling out big stadiums, but I think had Bob Dylan kind of kept his MO from the 60s, and when you went to see Bob Dylan now, you still kind of got some of that 60s Dylan.
Yeah.
I think he could have been a lot bigger and then been playing the big stadiums and arenas and doing that tour. But he kind of went a different direction with his music. He's like, I don't want to just do that, you know, so all his songs are different. So even if he sings Tangled Up in Blue, you hear Tangled Up in Blue and that's it. And then it's like, oh, this is Tangled Up in Blue that we're listening to. I didn't know that for the first 2 minutes because I couldn't tell, because it sounds nothing like the original track. So had he not gone that direction, he could probably be doing that. So I think if the Beatles wanted to do something similar, they could, where they could pull the trigger and do a huge 50,000, 60,000, 70,000, 80,000 people stadiums, or they could be like, we're going to do things a little different So we're going to do these like 8,000 person shows and we're going to just kind of have fun and experiment.
Yeah. And just be more close to the audience because, you know, it's a little bit different times today than they did from before. But no, that's actually a great point. In discussing about intimate settings, I have an artist that I thought of for a wonderful intimate setting.
All right.
The artist that I would love to see in a more intimate setting. So this was one artist that I literally took out of time and just said, I'm going to put him into this intimate area, is Joe Cocker. I think Joe Cocker in a soft, intimate jazz club-like environment, like the Dakota Jazz Club, would be absolutely wonderful. And so I didn't put a time period on this. It's just kind of like that idea. And then it would have to be pre-2000s because I'm also thinking like I want cigarette smoke all around us, maybe a little bit of herbal jazz cigarettes us. Just kind of having that intimate, smoky, like Saturday night red special kind of a fucking feeling, I think would be great. And then having Joe Cocker with his, frankly, I just think his vocals are out of this world amazing. And his songs are timeless and very unique, where it really sets up the night for a really great experience, I think. I would take him in any era that that he performed in, mainly because I really don't think that I heard of from seeing his performances online or anything like that, from even into the 2000s, his vocals were fantastic, actually.
Right, right.
He didn't lose anything like we occasionally see that with. Like one of my examples is Van Morrison had some rough patches recording live music because of his vocals. They just weren't like living up to the standard that he did. But now that I think about it, it would be really awesome if this was a double bill of Van Morrison and Joe Cocker in the jazz club. That'd be so cool.
Should we just make that happen for you?
I know. That'd be so great. That'd be fantastic. So Van Morrison was also on my list. I think that's why I kind of threw him in here. But literally in every video you see, Joe Cocker, you know, he has it going on for him. So I think what else is awesome about this intimate setting was that Joe Cocker really gives it his all when he's on stage. Like, he sweats profusely when on stage. So you're really seeing something really good in live. So in intimate setting, you get the rawest version of the vocal performance and the emotion. So if you really look at his facial expressions when he's, you know, up close and personal on those things, it's just fantastic. So then you'd be up close and personal. So really for me, when I first saw Al Stewart at the Dakota Jazz Club, it really impressed me with how great the intimate perspective of it was, and just really did give me a new perspective on it. So I feel like the engagement and storytelling that he could offer us would just enhance the experience above and beyond anything you would see at just a regular rock venue. If I had to say anything, songs you want to hear from him definitely is With a Little Help from My Friends, but more importantly, some of those slower kind of like rockers, like Woman to Woman, Jealous Guy, Cry Me a River, The Letter, just kind of those songs would be really great to hear him play in there. But definitely I would take Joe Cocker in a jazz club, like intimate setting like that.
Speaking of intimate settings, one artist, I guess you could call him an artist, that I'd like to hear, and this one's coming way out of right field on this one, and I actually kind of had some fun thinking about this one.
Yeah.
I'd like to see like Mozart, like in his prime.
Was that left field or right field? Because that feels
that was
like
right field.
That does feel like a right field one, brother.
I think I said right field. Did I not?
I don't know. I was like, once you said Mozart, it just, I'm like, damn, that's a good call.
We're a right field podcast. We made that very clear. Things come out of right field because right field's more weird. But seeing Mozart in like 1785 at some sort of general theater, you know, definitely be intimate. It wouldn't be a huge place. I don't know, a few hundred, maybe 1,000 people. Just the experience alone. Like, I'm just very curious. What was it like? Like, I know he performed for a lot of royalty and dignitary and that sort of thing, but did he ever do shows that were more for the common man or less, you know, for like the high society and more of like that middle ground? Because Mozart was kind of notorious for being a partier and being a little bit of an asshole? Like, did he bring any of that to the stage with him? Because I think that would be a cool experience to see that when, if he's on stage playing piano, or if he's, I don't know, I know he wrote all those symphonies. I don't know if he conducted. See, that's how so much I don't know about this. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, was he on stage kind of putting on a performance, or was it strictly business? So I'd like just to see that and what's going on, because I think that could be really just a cool experience to see someone who's so renowned hundreds of years later, and to go back into that time and witness it in the prime, what it was like, just to experience that. I think that'd be really cool.
No, I think that's an excellent choice. I didn't even go that deep, so I'm glad you did. That was great, pulling out the weird. And it's not even that weird, but it's just like nobody else would, I think, would have thought of that going back that far. That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I would take, you know, like a Beethoven or something too. Like, I, yeah, for composers, I'm a big Joseph Haydn fan. He's probably one of my favorites. Not that I can tell you that much about any one composer, but, you know, any of that era would be kind of cool. Like, Mozart came, then Beethoven and Haydn kind of followed shortly thereafter. But it'd be really cool just to experience that, because these guys were celebrities of their time. Like, they were the rock stars of their time. And so it'd be cool to see a rock star from the 1700s or the early 1800s and just experience that.
Yeah, that's a great aspect to think on. And I didn't even go that far. That was beautiful. To move on with one of my next choices, we already talked about Lennon McCartney, and I have my other L&M artist on this list. And it's also kind of in a intimate setting close to, but I had placed them, this artist, in the State Theater in Minneapolis. It's because I already saw them at the State Theater. And this is one concert that I forgot about to mention in our 13th episode of the greatest concerts. And I kicked myself because this was a great one, but I wanted to reinstitute it because I think seeing Loggins and Messina at the State Theater on September 1st of 2009 was one of the best concerts I ever saw. And the reason I would put myself up in there is to see it with my father. Like, I would change the person I saw because.
Okay. Yeah.
And there's a big reason, because I feel bad that I didn't pressure my dad to come down with this, because when we had seen about a year and a half before, Loggins and Messina were on the Today Show, and Jim Messina himself was pretty much pretty bad, you know, out of shape. Mm. It was
sure.
Your mama don't dancing, you know, so it was kind of like a sluggish performance. And so it really turned my dad off. He's like, oh shit, I don't know if I would see them. And last minute, probably about 3 days before the show, I got a couple tickets and my buddy Ian and I went. And so I want to see them again, because that was just a magical night. It was a beautiful show, but I would much rather see it with my dad. Yes, I turned my friend Ian onto Loggins and Messina after that, but my dad turned me onto Loggins and Messina, and I just wanted to share that experience with them. But also to have my dad see Loggins and Messina live, because he's never seen him. But I just think with that experience with my father, it would be a different night and day. And if I could go back to one spot in time, definitely would go back to it. And what they did in this show, the concert was outstanding from song one all the way to the end. It's exactly what you would want. The set list is exactly what you would want from a legend concert. I know a lot of people, like my friends Rusty and Dick, would be like, well, they're not legends. That's like, well, no, I love them, you piece of shit. I love those guys. But Kenny Loggins, his vocal performance on Peace of Mind was epic on this one. So absolutely wonderful. They did a double encore. It's one of the best encores that I ever saw. They did Your Mama Don't Dance and Nobody But You, which actually started off their first album. And then they came back for the second encore and the Danny song, which is absolutely one of the sweetest ways to end it. Very intimate, very great, but very rocking, very almost epic enough. But that's one that I would go see the artists, but see them with somebody else. So stretching the rules a little bit, but it's with my dad, it would have been a whole different experience on top of it. So it probably would have been even better.
That's a great point, because a concert can change just depending on who you're with. Yep. And if you're with the right people, it can make the night or the experience that much more enjoyable. If the band's already good and you're with someone who you can share that moment with, yeah, that can make it even better. And I think one similar to that idea is, like, I'd like to see, like, the Grateful Dead at like a summer camp or a Bonnaroo type festival, but in like 1977.
Yeah.
So like in the 70s, or like Grateful Dead at Red Rocks too, like any of those kind of shows, because Part of it is the band and how good they are and how great they sound. But a big part of those shows is the crowd and the people, and everyone's so carefree and enjoying the moment and just living, being present. There's peace, love, and dancing and drugs if you want them. So there's a lot going on there. I think to experience that kind of show, to see that musicianship and experience that crowd in that time when it was like at its peak popularity, when it was just the happening thing, I think that would be a really cool show at that kind of environment in that time to see.
Yeah, definitely. I think the Grateful Dead in that environment is exactly what we're trying to get with this kind of list that we're creating.
For sure.
Here. And it's for that sure. type of feel. And that's kind of the feel I was going for that last one. But you did mention Red Rocks, and that leads me to my final artist of the top five that I was considering for the top spot. And that's the opportunity missed last year that I wanted to do. And that was seeing the Black Keys at Red Rocks. Mm-hmm. And I've seen the Raconteurs, I've seen Jack White, I've seen Dan Auerbach twice solo, but I've never seen the Black Keys.
And the Arcs.
I saw the Arcs. Yeah, they were fantastic. So it's one of those things where I got, you know, COVID took that away from me because that was going to be a great show. Marcus mm-hmm. King Band and Gary Clark all at Red Rocks. And I tell you what, the idea of seeing a two-piece band, and mostly the Black Keys is what I'm focusing on because I've seen Gary Clark and I want to see Marcus King, but Black Keys are, you know,
let's see Matt Bonnaroo.
They are one fantastic group that is the epitome of like rock blues right now, and that's my jam. That's our jam, mm-hmm. basically. Yeah. And so when I think back on that, just that beautiful, a small group, two-piece group. Of course, they have other musicians, but a small group behind with a beautiful back setting. This absolutely raw scenery, rocks and various light plant life surrounded yep. by nature and rocks, while the best blues rock band of this generation is just ripping out some rocks, rock and roll and blues. You got Carney's drumming, which would probably shake and just want to like start a earthquake at there. This would be just an absolute wonderful, beautiful scenery to see this group in. So Black Keys at Red Rocks would have been awesome last year. And I'm going to say even till to this day, it would still be a fucking phenomenal show.
Have you seen a show at Red Rocks?
And that's the other thing too. Yeah, I actually haven't. So
okay.
I that's the other thing. I've seen pictures.
Yep.
You know, when I was dating my friend Amanda for a while, she was telling me all about it, and we were going to go to that show. And then 10 days later, I was going to go to Chicago and see the Black Keys with Gary Clark with you in Chicago. So it was like this wonderful plan I had of seeing artists in multiple cities. That was the one spot that I said, nope, I want it. If my first show can be Black Keys at Red Rocks, that would be the best Red Rocks show I will probably see.
Yeah, that would be a great show. Red Rocks is a lot of fun. Definitely recommend getting out there to check it out. It's a cool experience.
I got to do it.
So my last one, the one that I was thinking of, so I kind of bookend a couple favorites of mine. And this last artist, I've talked about him on the show a lot, and he's one of my favorite guitar players, and that's John Mayer.
Oh, yeah.
But this one's a specific show, so it's not kind of a made-up venue or made-up place and time. I would actually want to see the live recording of his album Where the Light Is, which came out in 2007. I believe the album itself was recorded in 2006, like late 2006. At the Nokia Theater in Los Angeles, I believe. And this is the album that I really fell in love with John as a musician and a guitar player. It's probably my favorite live album, just period, of all live albums. And I'm not good at picking favorites or tops or lists of anything, but this is one that always comes back when it's like, yep, this is my favorite live album. Because he does such a great job. It starts off with there's like a 5 or 6 song acoustic performance that sounds very, very good. Just the finger picking and brilliant guitar playing there. And then the middle portion, that's my favorite portion, is that blues set. The John Mayer trio, that's Steve Jordan, Pino Palladino, and John Mayer. And it's so good. They do a lot of blues covers, and it's got some of my favorite solos just in general too. This solo fun, Wait Until Tomorrow, Who Did You Think I Was, Out of My Mind, just some brilliant, brilliant work. And then that last third is like his poppy stuff, but it's still rooted in like rock music. So it's a lot of what you hear on Continuum and some of those songs that he's known for being a little more poppy with, but he definitely like blueses him up a little bit. There's some still really good guitar soloing. So this would be just one of those because it's my favorite live album. I would love to have been at that theater to see that show live because why not?
Oh, totally. And I think that was a great view of looking at what shows you would want to do that with. Because if I would have thought of that, I would have probably picked James Brown at the Apollo, thinking back on my favorite live albums too. That would have been a great one. But I do got to admit, that's the album that you turned me into a John Mayer fan. Once you borrowed that to me when we were at work, you're like, no, take two of these.
Yeah.
Call me in the morning. You know,
take two of these.
And I did.
Throw this on. Call me in the morning. Yeah, it's good.
No, so I think that's a great way to end our list on, because John Mayer in that live setting, the trio was fucking killer. And you're right, that performance in itself changed me from, oh, he's just, you know, your body's a wonderland, to now it's right. Like, damn, you are a musician, brother.
Right. And I think that's what did it for me. And that's kind of the gospel that I try to preach to people when people are like, what? He's one of your favorites? And I'm like, hold on. Like, we're not talking Body is a Wonderland. We're talking blues music and blues guitar. Yeah. Listen to this and then tell me you're not a fan.
Exactly. Any rock fan that doesn't appreciate a good guitar player and they don't like... Actually, I gotta say, who doesn't appreciate John Mayer but says that they are a guitar aficionado and guitar fans? If they say they don't like John Mayer, it's like, come on, you don't know what you're talking about then.
Right? Come on.
Yeah.
Come on.
All right, Ringer, you want to before that needle lifts up off the record here, you want to send us home with a little last minute cleanup?
Yep, some cleaning up to do. Thank you for listening. We're on social media if you want some more: Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. All at On the Record Music. You can also visit our website at www.ontherecordmusic.com, where you can listen to all of our shows. You can sign up for our email list or check out the podcast app that you're listening in right now. And you can see the links to actually all of those things. So you can visit on us there. You don't even have to search because we made it easy for you. And like I said, next week, episode 100, we got some big announcements. We're going to do an album review on top of that, but we got some big things coming up. So we're going to announce that as well.
Oh, yeah. So people tune on in. Here's what we got. And I think we'll be popping some champagne for sure. And one of our artists we mentioned today will be the album that we do next week.
That's right.
So come on in, kick on in. And until that needle drops back on the record, we're going to lift it off and sign off. So everybody, peace.
Goodbye.